So I've got a question for the kids out there, and you have to be 10 and under to answer this question. What is an old age? Where are the kids? What's an old age? What? 99, that's a good one. What else? 90. You guys are generous. 100, 1,000? I don't know. We have some very nice children. Because I remember when I was about 10 years old, this lady in my church got married, and I thought she was so old. I mean, she was just so old. It was like the last person, you know, to get married in the church. And later, she became my voice teacher and a very good friend. And one day, I asked her, had the guts to ask her, how old were you when you got married? And her answer made my heart stop. 26. And I was 25 at the time and not married, so. Age is a relative thing. And when the angel comes to Zechariah in the temple and tells him that he and his wife, Elizabeth, are going to have a baby, we don't know exactly how old he was, except for that he said that he was an old man. And a very generous stroke to his wife just said that she was getting on in years. But no matter what age they were, whether it was, you know, in their 30s or 40s or 50s or 60s, he felt old, and he felt like his time had passed. And so he had some questions about how this would actually come about. And we don't know why, but for some reason, his questions led the angel to strike him mute for the rest of the pregnancy. He couldn't speak for 9 months. Can you imagine what would happen to all of us if we couldn't speak for 9 months? We might learn a few things, actually. Might be good practice. I thought, what if I started like not speaking next year before Advent? But I don't think it would go over very well. Be a lot of interesting sermons. So the silence was broken on the eighth day after his son was born, the day where by Jewish custom, they took their son to the temple to be circumcised and to be named. And Elizabeth, when she was asked what the name of their son was, said his name was John. And no one believed her because this was not a family name. Why would they name their son John? And they asked Zechariah, and he took a tablet and he wrote out John, which means God is gracious. And at that moment, he began to speak. Now, when my first daughter was born, and they handed it to her, all I could say, and I didn't know if it was a boy or a girl because we hadn't found out before, all I could say was, it's a baby. It took me a minute to even realize that I should check, you know, to see if it was a boy or a girl or what was going on. I was just so surprised there was even a baby there. And Zechariah is much more eloquent than I was in that moment. I'm wondering if those 9 months of not speaking, those 9 months of praying and wondering and pondering this gift that was coming and what it meant, actually gave him the words in that moment to speak this prayer that Duane just read for us, that is traditionally called the Benedictus. And in Catholic tradition and more liturgical traditions, they pray it every single day. Every single day they pray these words of a man who is rejoicing in the birth of his son and wondering what it all means. For almost 2,000 years, people have prayed this prayer every day and found in it hope and promise and encouragement to keep moving forward with an imagination for the kingdom of God in this world. Peace. As I said to the kids, when I looked up the definition of peace, I couldn't find anything that said what it wasn't. It all was about what it's not. But I think peace, it's maybe because peace is less a state of being that we somehow attain and more a way of living. That it's less about something we receive and more about something that we are. That it's not about what's absent, but maybe peace could be about what's present, what's here. And when I read Zechariah's prayer, I hear a man who's living and breathing peace. In his time of silence, he goes from a person who is just doing his duties in the temple and doing what he's supposed to do to a man that has been reborn with an imagination for a world that could be different. The man that believes that God is interacting with the world in such a way that there could be peace. This kind of imagination honestly feels really elusive to me these days. The last few weeks, with the reports from Paris and from Mali and from San Bernardino and from Burundi and from Syria and places all over the world constantly have me a little worn down. They have me looking around the corner wondering what's going to go on. They have me looking into things and fearfully afraid for my life, for the life of my children, for the life of my country, and all the unhelpful rhetoric around it doesn't help for me, because I just want to sit down and cry for what's going on. And fear and despair have felt very close. On top of that, my daughter got her license, and she's been driving in these snowy roads. I'm driving on these snowy roads. Everything feels very vulnerable. The New York Times reported this week that many people are experiencing this in our country, that if someone grabs into their purse too quickly in a store, they're afraid that it's going to be a weapon. They're afraid to drop their kids off at school for fear of what's going to happen. There is a lot of despair and fear around us. The problem with despair is that it is the very fuel on which violence breeds. One person has said that violence is the behavior of someone incapable of imagining other solutions to the problems at hand. Violence is the behavior of someone incapable of imagining other solutions to the problems at hand. Which makes Zechariah's words so striking and so needed for us today. By the tender mercy of our God, the dawn from on high will break upon us to give light to those who sit in darkness and to guide our feet in the ways of peace. Experienced peacemaker and professor of peace building and Mennonite author Jean-Paul Lederach wrote a book about 10 years ago that I just picked up called The Moral Imagination. In all of his peace-building work around the world, encountering some of the most violent, tense, and awful situations, he realized that peace is more about the skills that it takes to get people to talk and to resolve conflict, that peace and peacemakers have to have a way of being that is more of an art. They have to have a way of being that helps them be a different person in the midst of conflict, not just what they do, but who they are. And so he writes about four disciplines of the peacemaker. And he calls it the moral imagination because they are all based on imagination. Four disciplines of the peacemaker that I shared with the kids earlier. And they are relationship, complexity, creativity, and risk. Relationship, complexity, creativity, and risk. The first one is relationship. Relationship implies this sense of being able to imagine that everyone around us is included in this web of relationship. It's a foundational theological truth. That God, who chooses to be in community from the very beginning, that's kind of what the Trinity means, God, who chooses to be in community, has placed us in community with each other, and we're all united and we're connected. And so when we can live, even in this world that wants to separate us and polarize us, if we can have an imagination that sees us all as connected, that's where possibilities of peace can emerge. In Sierra Leone, there was a war for 11 years. 11 years. Children were conscripted into the army, and part of their initiation into fighting was to kill or hurt those that they were closest to, family members, friends, people in their community. So in each small community in Sierra Leone, you have incredible strife and struggle and grief and pain. Just imagine. And so when the war ended, there were large-scale peace-building efforts that happened and reconciliation on the higher levels. But one man, John Calker, believed that it needed to happen at a smaller level as well, that the pain that exists between my neighbor and I is not necessarily going to be taken care of by these large movements. So he began a process, and with the help of actually a friend of mine here in the U.S., a process called Fumble Talk, which is family talk. And what they would do is gather communities if they'd want. They'd have done a lot of prep work, but gather them at night with a bonfire going. And during the bonfire, the victims would be able to share what and how they had been hurt. And the perpetrator, if they were there, was allowed to respond. And then the village elders were able to give some sort of response, always based on reconciliation, always based on relationship. And one night, what happened is that a young man came up and he said, "I have something to say." And there was a family that had been waiting for their loved one to come home, assuming that he was lost somewhere in the country and that someday he would come home. And he said, I killed your loved one." And the family was in shock, as you can imagine, and grieving, and they stopped the bonfire and they took a moment to process that. And then the leaders of the Fumble Talk said to this family, "What do you want to do?" And they looked at this man who had taken the life of someone they loved, and they said, "He is our son. We know him in this community. We have worked with him. He is our son." And so in the process that ensued, this man agreed to serve them and be a part of their family, to help them farm, to help them with household chores, to continue to make reparations for the damage that he had done, which could never fully be repaired. And yet, because this family lived in a community and because they had seen him and had a larger story about who he was than this act, they were able to see him in this web of relationships. And when I think about the people that I'm struggling to forgive, or the people that I'm angry with, it doesn't compare in any way to what happened in that Sierra Leone village. And one practice that I have been doing recently, and I invite you to consider, is to think about the person that I am struggling with and to imagine the flow of God's love enveloping them and enveloping me. And to just imagine that when I look at them or I think of them, instead of going to that place of blaming and polarizing and pushing them away and reminding myself of how angry I am and why I have every right to be angry, inviting them and inviting myself into the flow of God's love. And I just invite you to think about that practice this week and notice how it may change how you view others, how it may expand your understanding of what relationships are. And imagine the peace that can become possible when we see each other in that web of relationships. The second mark of a peacemaker is complexity, to practice the discipline of complexity, to realize that there is always more than meets the eye to any story. And that when we hold two seemingly opposing ideas or truths together, and we hold them without needing to make one right or one wrong, often a deeper truth will emerge. Often we'll find something that's true underneath all of these disparate ideas that we have up here. And so a peacemaker is able to hold that kind of complexity, to remember that every person has a story, and that we don't have all the facts and we don't understand everything. And so a peacemaker does not rush to judgment, does not rush to decide quickly, but is willing to hold those two things. Or maybe there's three or four. This week we had a movie here called Traces of the Trade. And it was the story of a family who discovered in their ancestral history in New England that their family had been the primary slave trading family in the United States. And they traveled to Africa, and they traveled to Cuba, and they discovered and explored the roots of this in their family. And what struck me was that for them and for myself as well, many of us assume that that slave trading happened in the South, not in the North. And so it was a change of perspective for them, because they thought, well, we're from the North, and we're progressive, and we're liberal, and we've funded civil rights, and we were the abolitionists. And so there was this, began to be this complexity to their own identity, that here in their family was this slave trading, and here also is their desire for peace and better race relations. And so out of that, as they held those two things together and people have moved forward, they have began to see new possibilities for how blacks and whites in this country can meet and can have conversation and can build relationships and can have peace. And their willingness to hold the complexity of their ancestry and their desire for harmony has led to new possibilities. So peacemakers refuse to see the world in either or. They are willing to hold opposing ideas and see what emerges. Third, peacemakers make space for creativity. Walter Brueggemann said that every totalitarian regime is afraid of the artist. Creativity defies the barrenness and the violence that we experience. And it can happen in so many ways. It can be your coloring sheet. It can be your chosen craft. It can be the way you live your life. It can be the way that you interact with someone else. But making and creating and fostering that creative space is an act of peace. On Friday, my daughter turned in a civil rights essay that she's been working on to end her civil rights unit at school, and she's been working really hard on this essay, and to her teacher's credit, they have had her going in. They didn't ask her. She was going in voluntarily on her lunch breaks after school to keep working on this essay and to make it better and better. And she even asked for my help, and she even took it when I gave it to her, which is amazing. You know, as a parent, you're kind of prepped for how are we going to deal with this. And so we had been working on this, and she had been reading me the opening paragraph, over and over the last few weeks. So she's just so excited about how it was developing and these words that she was using. And she said on the ride to school, she said, "You and my teachers gave me great words." And I, you know, tried not to, you know, look too excited in the moment. Stay cool. But you and my teachers gave me great words. And I thought, that is the work of creativity, to give great words to our world. Words that heal, words that inspire new possibilities, words that pull us out of the cycle of violence and despair. Creativity is any way that we can give different words and new space so that peace can emerge. This morning, I opened my door to let the dog out, and the wind was blowing, and the owl was hooting, and I just stood there for a minute to listen. And I thought, this is a moment of creativity as well, to just make space for something new and beautiful to arise. Peacemakers make space for creativity. And lastly, peacemakers accept the inherent risk of living the mystery of peace. Violence is a known quantity in our world. We know it. We can count how many people have been affected. We can count what happened and tell stories on the news. Peace and what's ahead of us is unknown. It's a mystery. And so to live towards peace requires a certain level of risk, requires a certain level of, I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen, but it is worth it to me to follow in the footsteps of this father whose son was born and spoke words of peace. It is worth it to me to follow in the footsteps of Mary, who praised God in the midst of her baby being born, even though she wasn't sure what it all meant. It is worth it to me to follow in the footsteps of a rabbi, Jesus, who spoke of peace. To risk peace is to truly embody the spirit of Christmas. And I'd like to just read a poem by Madeline L'Engle as we close today, called The Risk of Birth. This is no time for a child to be born. With the earth betrayed by war and hate, and a comet slashing the sky to warn that time runs out and the sun burns late. That was no time for a child to be born in a land in the crushing grip of Rome. Honor and truth were trampled by scorn. Yet here did the Savior make his home. When is the time for love to be born? The inn is full on the planet Earth, and the comet the sky is torn. Yet love still takes the risk of birth. Yet love still takes the risk of birth. O God, guide our feet on the path of peace, and may we be peacemakers in this world. Amen.